In the new book, The Agitators, Three Friends Who Fought for Abolition and Women's Rights, Dorothy Wickenden, longtime executive editor at The New Yorker, traces the history of women's progressive politics in the U.S. through the lives of three women: Harriet Tubman, Martha Wright, and Frances Seward. Before women could be elected and participate in Congress, they made their impact behind closed doors, and readers get the story of abolition, the Underground Railroad, the early women's rights movement, the Civil War, and much more. Again, the name of the new book is The Agitators by Dorothy Wickenden. It is published by Scribner, and we welcome Dorothy Wickenden to the program this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you here.
It's a pleasure for me, too.
What brought you to this subject, to write about these three friends?
It started somewhat serendipitously. I was actually researching my earlier book, Nothing Daunted, about my grandmother who grew up in Auburn, New York. And she had told me that her grandparents lived next door to William H. Seward and his wife. So I was in Auburn to check out that claim. And while I was there, I got a private tour of the museum and learned that Frances Seward had harbored fugitive slaves in her old basement kitchen. And she was very close friends with another renegade around the corner, Martha Coffin Wright, another young mother with a brood of children, who also harbored fugitive slaves in her basement kitchen. And then I was told that Harriet Tubman spent the last 48 years of her life in the same town, Auburn, New York. And I just thought that was such a remarkable thing and potentially a way to talk about both how the Underground Railroad worked and, you know, how abolitionists and women's rights advocates, because all three women were both, how those movements sprung up and continued. And so it became kind of a story about how do social justice movements occur, and often they occur through the good work of people who otherwise are completely under the radar, as women, and especially black women, tended to be in that era.
Can you talk a little bit about the nature of the friendship?
It really was an extraordinarily close friendship. It began as they were introduced through a mutual contact. Actually, it was Martha Coffin Wright's older sister, Lucretia Mott, who was by the early 1840s, when Tubman liberated herself and went to Philadelphia, which is where Lucretia Mott lived. Mott was a world-renowned and despised activist on behalf of human rights, broadly seen. She, too, harbored fugitive slaves. Harriet Tubman, when she arrived in Pennsylvania, made it her business to get to know every abolitionist in town, quickly became close to Lucretia Mott, and she clearly needed more contacts on her Underground Railroad expeditions, which she was beginning to think about at that time. In the early 1840s, 50s. Martha went down to Philadelphia regularly to visit her family there. And clearly it was Lucretia Mott who introduced Martha to Harriet Tubman. And then in Auburn, Martha who introduced Harriet Tubman to Frances. Auburn became a regular stop on Harriet Tubman's Underground Railroad journeys as she traveled back with her passengers on at least 12 excursions all the way up into Canada. And not only were these three women colleagues on the Underground Railroad, they became very close friends, and they trusted each other. Tubman served as a great inspiration to these white abolitionists who had only kind of thought in abstract terms about abolition. And then they met this woman who was this unbelievable force of nature. And so they helped her. She inspired them. And the whole thing became this kind of part of this propulsive force that directly led to the Civil War.
I want to get to Harriet Tubman specifically in a moment, but before we do, I want to talk about Frances Seward. Fascinating because, as mentioned, wife of governor, then senator, then Secretary of State William Seward. So that power dynamic in the relationship, I assume, plays a part in some way.
It does. And it's such a fascinating marriage because Frances Seward started out, she got married at the age of 19, and she started out as she was very recessive. She had health problems. She had thought that her husband was going to become a local lawyer and they would just kind of settle down and have a very traditional life. Instead, he dedicated himself to politics. He was a brilliant politician. She hated all the wheeling and dealing and, you know, skullduggery of electoral politics. And she hated that life. She hated Washington. She refused to live in Washington, which where slavery was legal. And it was the biggest slave market for slavery in the world, just about. So she stayed in Auburn, and she engaged surreptitiously in her activities, and also wrote to her husband, usually often three or four times a week, and she kept pressing him on these two issues relentlessly over the decades. And once Seward becomes Secretary of State to Abraham Lincoln, the letters become more and more insistent. She doesn't understand why the administration will not move on emancipation immediately. He explains to her, this is a war. This was administration policy at the beginning of the war. This is a war to save the Union. It is not to liberate the slaves. And she was furious at this and wrote him a letter. Her letters are just remarkable. And she said, how can you say this? You've dedicated your entire life to fighting slavery, which he had. He was very outspoken on the subject, and to the point where his life was threatened a number of times. But he was also an incredibly savvy politician. And like Lincoln, he knew that in politics, you have to move when the time is right. And the country wasn't ready. And the Constitution did not give them the power to emancipate the slaves until Lincoln figured out a way to do it constitutionally as a military necessity. And even then, that wasn't enough for Frances. She knew that this was just a military measure. It would not last forever. So they would need a 13th Amendment to banish it from the country. Anyway, so it goes on, and it becomes these letters become a wonderful prism on the decade, the antebellum North and the rising sentiment against slavery and the South. And it becomes a document about this quite difficult marriage, but loving still, right to the end. And then it just becomes a kind of a different way politically to see how these ideas found their way into the world.
And as you write in the book, and as just we glean from what you just described of Frances, certainly the most conventional of the three, and yet would be a person who would give the freedom seekers money and referrals and aiding in their education.
Yes, and not only that, she became so close to Harriet Tubman that by 1859, she renounced her role as Seward's. She would go down to Washington once a year to serve as Seward's hostess. And she had done that very reluctantly ever since he had become senator. She finally decided that she had had enough. It was completely hypocritical. She couldn't do that. She hated those parties. She went back to Auburn, and she wanted to dedicate herself even more fully to the cause of abolition. And it occurred to her that she had inherited all of this land. She was really an aristocrat, and she had inherited all of this land from her father. It was her land, not her husband's, and she decided that she would like to sell Harriet Tubman a house and 7 acres a mile down the street in Auburn to aid her on her Underground Railroad expeditions, because she, you know, this was a journey of 500 miles, and her parent, Harriet Tubman, had by then had liberated virtually every member of her family, including her elderly parents, but they were all up in Canada. And so Frances knew how close Harriet was to her family. She decided it would be much better, much easier for Tubman if they were in Auburn rather than way up in Canada. So she did this with Seward's approval, and it's always been portrayed by historians as William H. Seward's decision. But in fact, it had to be Frances's decision. I concluded after doing all of this research. And it turns out that Seward, at the time that the sale actually went through, was off on a world tour. So, you know, really, again, it just shows the kind of tenacity of Frances Seward, who described herself earlier in the decade as a timid woman. Well, yes, in one respect, but in others, you know, incredibly courageous. And it, of course, was completely illegal to sell any property to a fugitive slave.
Let us talk about Harriet Tubman for a moment, probably now the most famous of the three women, the most well-known. And you write about her very funny, very no-nonsense, and strategically a brilliant woman.
She was, and this was something I hadn't thought through, and I didn't really know in any great detail until I began the book. I had always been fascinated by the stories of her Underground Railroad exploits, but that was almost the limit of my knowledge. And I think for many Americans, that remains true to this day. There's been great scholarship on Tubman that's sort of revealed many facets of her life. I mean, that was so her Underground Railroad chapter only took 10 years of her life, and she lived until she was 93, and she was an activist until the very end. And one of the things that I saw as I was putting all this together was how brilliant she was at getting her sort of creating her own oral history. So she couldn't read or write, but she did speak before large audiences before the war. She told the same stories again and again to these audiences and to her friends. She made friends with all the most important abolitionists and transcendentalists in Boston. So she, and in Philadelphia and in New York. So she had this great network of supporters, some of whom were financial supporters of hers. And she was just constantly getting her story out there. And invariably, people who listened to her speak, or who people who were close to her, like Frances and Martha, were just completely bowled over by her. But I think this was, as they should have been, but I think this was also a very calculated decision on Tubman's part. She knew the historic resonance of what she was doing, and she wanted it remembered. And so it was. And she a friend of hers who lived near Auburn did write not a very good, frankly, very slim biography of Tubman. It was basically Tubman dictating to this woman, Sarah Bradford, the key stories in her life. And it's, you know, today it reads abysmally because it's told in dialect and it's just not very good. Nevertheless, those stories I found everywhere because she was telling them to everyone whenever she had the opportunity, not in a boastful way at all. She was extreme, she was funny, as you said, and very kind of matter of fact. And she was deeply religious. She believed that God guided her in everything she did and kept her safe. So she didn't express any sense of self-importance about this. She just thought that this was the job that God had given her to do.
Dorothy Wickenden is our guest on the roundtable this morning. The new book is The Agitators, Three Friends Who Fought for Abolition and Women's Rights. About Martha Wright, you say in the book, she had a mutinous mind. How so?
She did indeed. And her family history is so fascinating. You know, you can go down so many rabbit holes when you do this kind of book, but right. It was very pertinent that her family were founding Quakers in Nantucket, going all the way back to that little community when it started as a kind of group of rebels against Puritan America. And so she had been brought up with very strong radical Quaker beliefs about the equality of women and about how Black Americans should have full equality too. And so that had just been, you know, she was just steeped in that ideology. And she also happened to have this incredibly rebellious personality. She hated going to school as a young girl. She said all these children were like little snails creeping reluctantly to school and, you know, dealing with these strict teachers. She found after she got married and she started having children, she felt completely constricted In that era, women were supposed to stick to their domestic sphere, you know, breed as many children as they could and cook and clean. And she did all of that because they didn't have that much money. She had six children and she just couldn't stand it. So that she then became in 1848 one of the organizers with her older sister, Lucretia Mott, of the Seneca Falls Convention. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who became kind of the leading voice at that convention, immediately saw that Martha Wright was a kindred spirit and basically made her her deputy in this new national movement she was starting. And Frederick Douglass was at the Seneca Falls Convention as well. And Martha tactically became a good friend of his. She admired him enormously. He had become an internationally renowned abolitionist, only 10 years out of slavery himself. And she went out of her way to invite him to come to her house every time he came through Auburn on one of his lecture tours. And she invited him to dinner and to spend the night with the idea of shocking her neighbors, because she thought that was the only way that people could ever realize the errors of their ways, was to show that social equality not only was possible, it was desirable. And that was what she told these shocked neighbors. And she wrote about all of this very entertainingly in the letters that she wrote to Lucretia Mott. And so she described one party where she overheard one woman whisper to another, "Who is that fine-looking lady?" And the other woman whispered, "That is Mrs. David Wright. She is a very dangerous woman."
She's also the probably the least known of the three. Her accomplishment somewhat obscured by history.
Yes, and probably somewhat obscured by her absolutely, you know, unstoppable older sister, Lucretia Mott, who was 14 years older. So she was well down the path of radicalism by the time Martha grew up. And Martha in those early years was a little intimidated by this amazing sister who was known around the world. And Martha was torn, as Frances was. Must I fulfill the role that has been allotted to me by white men who made this country, or do I break free of it? And it's almost hard for us to imagine how difficult it was to break free of those constraints. Women just weren't allowed to speak in public at all at that point. It was considered, and the idea of women's rights was considered even more aberrational than the idea to the average American than abolition. So it took a lot of guts to do this. And, you know, she was hated in Auburn, except, of course, by her dear friend, Frances Seward.
Let us talk for a moment when, as you explore these three friends who fought for abolition and for women's rights, and we look at the aforementioned history books, and I want to talk just a moment about the men of the story. Lincoln and Seward and Daniel Webster and Frederick Douglass and Charles Sumner and John Brown, William Lloyd Garrison, others. How were they helpful, and did they challenge and you know, not to put too fine a point on it, screw up what these women were trying to do?
Well, they did. They played different roles, each of them. So mostly they were extremely helpful. William Lloyd Garrison was what we would describe him today as a feminist. I mean, absolutely no doubt about it. And he thought it was great. This was exactly what they should be doing. But it starts the alliance between the abolitionists and the incipient women's rights movement was, it started out with women being advocating with white and black abolitionists for abolition. And so these women, and that was way back, I mean, the American Anti-Slavery Society, Garrison's group, was started in 1833. So this was very early. And at that point, the men in that society would not allow women, even though Garrison himself would have allowed them, but a majority did not. So women started their own anti-slavery societies, learning from the tactics of friends like Garrison, how to organize and how do you write, you know, how do you write a petition to Congress saying slavery must be abolished? How do you publicize your work? You know, how do you get important people to come and talk at your conventions? And so Garrison, and I'm just taking him as one example, and Frederick Douglass was another, were happy to come and be speakers at these conventions. So they worked hand in glove, and they often held their conventions back to back so that people who were interested could go to both. Seward was a little more complicated because he was a savvy politician. He knew he was afraid of allowing his wife to go too far and too publicly on either on women's rights or on abolition because he was in Washington, and it was a very Southern, very conservative town. So he would write. He maintained active correspondences with a number of these abolitionists, including Frederick Douglass. And when Douglass would say, you need to be more overt, you need to push harder on these issues, Seward would say, no, that's your job. You need to go out, speak to the public, bring them around to this idea. And when enough people see that the time has come, then I can get these bills passed.
When you look at this story, and as you say, the tremendous research that you did to put it together, what do you hope readers ultimately get out of it?
One of the things that has really pleased me so far is that readers totally see the connections between what was going on at that most divisive time in American history and what has been going on in recent years now. So I kept thinking about this as I was writing the book, and this is what I was saying about social movements, how when there are great injustices, so take, you know, today, I mean, the Derek Chauvin trial is going on right at this moment, and police brutality against young black men in particular is so pervasive, and the perpetrators are so rarely convicted. It's still, unclear what's going to happen in that case. What can be done? Well, we now are seeing the modern version of some of what we saw in the 1850s. So look at Black Lives Matter and the all of the demonstrations we've seen against police brutality in the past year. We also have seen in recent years the development of Me Too. And Frances is one of the things, actually the thing that radicalized Frances about women's rights was watching her sister, literally watching her sister who lived around the corner in from about 1829 to 1833 being brutalized, beaten by her husband. And there was nothing that Frances could do about it. There was nothing that her sister could do about it because women were at that time under the law, the property of their husbands. And it wasn't even, it was just accepted as just a condition that they had to put up with.
The name of the new book is The Agitators, Three Friends Who Fought for Abolition and Women's Rights. It is by Dorothy Wickenden. It is published by Scribner. Dorothy, I can't thank you enough for being with us on the program. I appreciate you sharing.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, The Agitators, by Dorothy Wickenden, published by Scribner. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.